You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 44 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Back in Renton, Washington.
After the long one-week hiatus.
One-week foray into Boulevard Park. Oh, it felt good, though.
It really did. I would like to begin today with a toast.
Oh.
To La La Land for winning the Best Picture Oscar.
Oh, congrats.
Turned it off right after that. Really nothing more you needed to see at that point.
You know, they went with the favorite, and who can blame them?
Always the right choice.
Favorites have dominated this year, and these last 2 years.
The important thing is, it's always over. No matter how much time there is left, it's over.
Yep.
If I've learned anything. What are we toasting with here?
We're toasting with, I got this earlier today, this is from Mac and Jack's Brewing Company in Redmond, Washington. So normally they do, Mac and Jack's is their signature beer, the African Amber, typically just called Mac and Jack's, right? Yes. They've expanded a little bit. They even started bottling beers. But I went to their brewery today and picked up a growler of their Ibis IPA.
You went to Redmond?
I went to Redmond.
I did not realize that. And I have to say, not
great. This is maybe the worst beer that we've drank. This is definitely the worst beer that we've drank.
I would say a lot of the sour beers.
Oh, come on.
You know my feelings about that.
But even like quality-wise...
It's weird because we had, at one point over the summer, I think, the Mac and Jack's Ibis Grapefruit IPA. I quite liked that.
I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
That was like one of my favorite grapefruit IPAs was the Mac and Jack's Grapefruit.
I mean, granted, I'm in on any grapefruit IPA, but that I thought was pretty good. This not so much. It seems like the internet kind of agrees with us.
Yeah, I think. So there's no rating from a Beer Advocate. If you're going to go, okay, so to rate beer where there's great inflation... Severe grain inflation.
Worse than the grain inflation I like to complain about on a regular basis.
Still a 68. Still a 68 on rate beer. That means it's like a 30 on Beer Advocate.
That's shocking.
Borderline undrinkable.
But fortunately, we will continue drinking it because we've got
to
get through it.
Well, when it comes to drinking, nevertheless, I persist.
You have a lot of grit when it comes to drinking.
So I had yesterday... from Two Beers Brewing Company in Georgetown, Washington, had, I think they call it like a trail pale ale, something like that.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And it was really good. You know, the thing that I took away from it most was how fresh it tasted. It was just like, it was a very hoppy ale, which this is going for hoppy, but it just doesn't taste that fresh.
Mm, the thing I took away from it is that all beers should have rhyming names.
I want to look up the actual name of this, but
it's something like that, isn't it?
It was something along those lines, but I'm going to find out the exact name.
You need me to fill while you're doing this?
Well, the thing to me is I think about Mac and Jack's. There's almost like a divide beer-wise.
In what sense?
That the beers that were made, particularly in Washington State, say pre-2010... I feel like the quality, they've been grandfathered in as notable beers because there just weren't that many available.
What about Manny's?
See, Georgetown is kind of an outlier.
Yeah, because they have successfully diversified, as we explored on last week's podcast.
But I think Mac and Jack's is like, people have had Wonderland Trail IPA.
See, my feeling about the Mac and Jacks is that they perfected the African Amber.
It was called the Off-Trail Pale.
Okay.
And it was... I don't know if they perfected. Let's not say... Let's just be careful about using the word perfected.
I mean, have you ever had a better African Amber beer?
I mean, I don't know if I've had any other African Amber beers.
Can't argue that. Mother's favorite beer.
Mac and Jack. She hasn't bothered to learn what it's called, but it's her favorite beer. And don't forget about Irish Death.
That's true.
I did a tasting at the Mac and Jack's brewery. They allow four tastings. They only had like five beers on tap. I'm getting a solid percentage of their beers.
Yes, they're not exactly rogue in terms of their variety of offerings.
All of them were pretty bad.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, I'll try this. I didn't even try the Ibis IPA because I was like, all right, I'll probably just get a growler. So actually, I tried everything.
You assumed that it would just be good because it's an IPA and it's made in the Pacific Northwest. And usually that's a recipe for at least adequacy.
Yeah. And it might have achieved adequacy.
The replacement level IPA in the Northwest is pretty high. I'd say that.
But I will give an official Fabulous Puncast shout up. We haven't done a shout up in a long time.
Okay.
A shout up to the Off Trail Pale Ale from Two Beers, because that was excellent.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, those hops were fresh. These hops, I'm not so sure about. But anyway, another toast I think is in order, though.
Is it?
Yeah.
To what?
To Kelsey Plum.
Oh, okay. We're going to transition to that. I mean, I agree that a toast is in order to Kelsey Plum. Scored 57 points yesterday against Utah.
Right, we should talk about this first, because this is one of the most important events in basketball in Seattle's history.
So not only scored 57 points, the most ever by a University of Washington basketball player, men's or women's, in a game, broke her own program record for women, which was 45 points, and Bob Hubriggs back in 1953 had the men's record of 49 points.
Yeah, take that, Hubriggs!
Which was threatened last year on senior day. Andrea Andrews had 47. But this year on her senior day, Kelsey Plum goes for 57, which is excellent because she needed 53 to pass Jackie Stiles and become the all-time leading scorer in NCAA Women's Division
pretty
I basketball.
Pretty amazing.
So
It was dare I say, in Alaska Airlines Arena. I think it was lit.
It was definitely lit. I mean, I haven't heard it like that in the arena in a while.
For either team.
Oh, yeah, no, that's what I mean. I mean, maybe volleyball did it at some point recently, and I wasn't there for that. But, yeah, that was the game of the year, and probably much longer than that. So I was covering this game for ESPN.com, and originally when they assigned it to me early in the week, it was kind of under the premise of, you know, maybe she gets to the record, but otherwise, you know, you're kind of setting up her being one game away from the record.
Mm-hmm.
Which she would then have set is still in Seattle because next week is the Pac-12 tournament at Key Arena, but not quite the same atmosphere as doing it in your home arena in front of exclusively home fans and everything like that. So she scored 25 on Thursday night against Colorado. It's like, okay, well now it's pretty clearly over because she, again, never scored more than 45 in a college game. Said she had once scored 50 in a high school game, but that was her career high.
Same.
At any level. And so, as you probably heard on last week's podcast, I convinced you to go to this game. You got there a little bit later than I did because of...
A lot later.
A lot later. No, I was
there for the good parts.
You were. First half, she goes for 22 in the first half. It's like, okay, this is pretty impressive. She's like actually making a legitimate run at it. But again, still thinking like at one point...
It was a long shot then.
At one point, I had a lead written that was like, you know, Kelsey Plum needed 53. She got close. Something along those lines of like, good effort, but not quite. And then third quarter really goes off. A couple and ones, some threes, scores 16 points in the third quarter to give her 38 from the game. And now you're like, okay, now we got something cooking here. Scores the first 2 minutes of the fourth quarter. It's like, okay, well, that now it's probably gone. But then Chantel Osahor, the Huskies' other star senior and second leading scorer, fouls out. And that's when the game kind of changed.
She just took over at that point. Kind of an interesting storyline, sub-storyline, is that Chantel Osahor fouling out and people being upset about that actually meant that Kelsey Plum was having the ball in her hands and was shooting from that point forward.
Which, not like she, I mean, again, she had scored 38 points to that point, but I think the stat was over the next 4.5 minutes, she scored 17, or the next 4 minutes, she scored 17 points.
It was and ones, threes. She had the heat. She hit two threes in a row and then had the heat check three. I was like, she needs to take this.
Oh, yeah, the heat check three was great. She missed that one. But that's the thing. It's like, she wasn't really forcing it with the exception of that shot. She was making the right play.
Okay, a couple questions for you.
Okay.
Well, first off, so the most impressive thing to me about this performance was that she scored 57 points in the rhythm of the game.
Right.
At no point, I mean, she only took 28 shots, right? Yeah. It was a very efficient 57 points.
I mean, had a bunch of free throws, as she normally does.
There were, I mean, only 13 of 16 free throws. That's not that many.
It's she could have shot better. She, her free throw percentage went down. She hurt her chances at getting into the 50-40-90 season to go along with being the leading scorer in the country.
But so she wasn't forcing it throughout the game. There were no shots that she took where I was like, ooh, I don't know about that one, right? This wasn't somebody going out there and like, it was the Anthony Bowie like missing on the other basket to try to get a triple-double.
Anthony Bowie called a timeout to advance the ball to get an assist while Doug Collins took the Pistons off the court. You're thinking of Ricky Davis.
This is Ricky Davis. Did he get that rebound?
No, that does not officially count as a rebound. As he discussed on a recent True Hoop podcast.
Wait, Ricky Davis did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a classic True Hoop podcast. You may want to go back in the archives and check that one out.
Were you on that one?
I was not, sadly. That was a Black Opinions Matter Monday podcast. I haven't been on one of those in a while.
Have you ever been on one?
Yeah, I went on to discuss Atlanta one time.
On the Black Opinions Matter Monday podcast?
I really hadn't coalesced as the Black Opinions Matter Monday podcast at that point, but I was in the proto version.
Discuss Atlanta one time.
That's like my main street cred.
Oh my God.
On that pod once. Anyways.
I have no idea what you're talking about. No, she scored within the rhythm of the game, though. It was a very impressive performance scoring-wise, right?
Oh, yeah.
So my question to you is, maybe you've seen more, but I'm pretty sure this is the most points that I've seen an individual player score in person.
I can't think of one game off the top of my head. In terms of 50-point games, I remember Anton Jameson had one against the Sonics in like 2001.
When he was on Golden State?
Yeah.
I kind of remember that.
He scored 50-plus points in back-to-back games. He did the next night at home against the Lakers.
Yeah, I remember that run.
Ray Allen had 54. That might be it in terms of 50-point performances.
Right?
I can't think of another one off the top of my head.
The only other one that I remember is Rashard Lewis in Japan.
Right. As far as the Sonic doing it within our time following the team.
Wasn't there a game where like Allen Iverson for Denver went off?
One of the games where they scored like 169 points against the Sonics?
I think it was in that game.
I don't think he had 50, though. And that was in Denver.
There was some game here where it was a later career Allen Iverson. I was like, oh, yeah, Allen Iverson's still awesome.
Yeah, as you would. No, that's probably the most points I've ever seen.
The most and this is you also, who's been to a lot of basketball games.
Let's see. Kobe, did he have 50 against the Blazers in the last game before he ruptured his Achilles? I think he did, but he still wouldn't have been 57. Yeah.
57 is a lot of points.
Like to me, one of the defining performances of my childhood was Jordan dropping the 55, the double nickel on the Knicks. Right after he came back the first time. And like, she beat that.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do. And she could have gotten a 60 if she really pushed.
Which is the all-time women's record.
I was wondering about that. I saw you tweet about that at some point. I was wondering if she was close to the all-time women's record. I figured that there was some like insane performance years ago.
No, it was in 1987, a player named Cindy Brown had 60 points for Long Beach State. And then just last year, Rachel Banham for Minnesota had 60.
Really?
But that was, I think I read that was in double overtime.
Huh.
So.
Well, I mean, this performance, like just being there, this is my first ever UW women's game that I've been to.
Really?
I think so.
Wow.
And this is definitely the right one. I've been to more volleyball games than I've been to.
It's all downhill from here. I hate to break it to you. That's the bad news.
Yeah, this happens every game, right? It's like taking the babies to their first ever UW women's game and Kelsey Plum scoring 57 points, breaking the all-time scoring record in their first game that they go to. I'm like, this happens every game. You wouldn't believe it.
So I was conducted interviews post-game as part of writing a story about this. I thought my favorite part of it was talking to Utah's coach, Lynn Roberts, who actually played at SPU, her college ball. And, you know, she was like saying she was basically marveling at it on the opposing bench.
Yeah.
There was just nothing they could do. And at some point you just say, like, holy cow.
There were things they could have done. Let me just say.
It seems like there are probably things they could have done.
They could have thrown a little bit more at Kelsey Plum.
I might have tried the box and won at some point there.
Double teaming Kelsey Plum. Just something, anything else, but whatever. The way that Kelsey Plum finishes, though, I think it's partially just being a left-hander, right? Being left-handed and going to the hoop means that she's coming at an angle that players aren't seeing that often.
That's interesting.
And then also her ability to finish on those shots. It's like, man, if Markelle Fultz could do this.
Right.
Right, yeah. If Markelle Fultz could do this, he could score 57 points also.
I mean, one of the things that Coach Roberts mentioned is, you know, the ability to score from three, from the mid-range, and then at the rim. And that's She's got all of those mastered at this point.
Okay, my next historical question for you.
Okay.
Is do you think Kelsey Plum is the greatest individual athlete that we have ever seen in Seattle?
I think we should wait and devote more time to this on a podcast, like okay. at the end of the season or towards the end of the season.
Okay.
Let's give her the NCAA tournament run here. Because I've been thinking a little
about really choke. Wow. Let's just see if Kicker V Jr. comes out of retirement. Wow. Let's see what happens.
But yeah, I want to address that subsequently. And also like the greatest single season in Seattle sports history.
Okay, I'm curious to talk about this because I think respective to her peers, this could be up there.
No, without question, it's up there. Yeah, it's definitely in the conversation.
Did you have any other thoughts on this one, covering it for ESPN? Or
I mean,
did you talk to Kelsey Plum after the game?
Yeah. And it's funny, she was under the weather. Not that much ended up getting
mad. This is the flu game?
Yeah,
Kelsey Plum flu game
someone
also?
Someone said that, and she was like, I'm not that sick. But it was funny. Apparently, her secret was...
I would have definitely leaned to do it if I were her.
I would have, too. She was going back...
She'd be like, yeah, IV before the game, halftime.
She was going back to the bench and eating applesauce on the bench during timeouts. And no. She was like, I couldn't wait to get back to the bench and get some more applesauce.
What? We were doing the same thing in the crowd, so
yeah, very similar. Yeah, so I mean, her voice was kind of lost, which is made it horrible that she didn't have to do a bunch of interviews about this.
I thought the thing that was kind of amazing was the national coverage that she got.
Yeah, the fact that it made the bottom line is like a specific section.
I think there's a notification about it.
Really?
People got ESPN notifications from the app about Kelsey Plum.
One of the funny things. Matt Calkins wrote his column in the Seattle Times about the fact that he wasn't planning to write about the game. He was going to write about the Husky men's basketball program for the Sunday paper.
He shouldn't do that.
Then
let me advise any person at any time not to do that.
Well, I mean, if you're there are things to write about. Then saw my tweet that she had 38 through three quarters and decided to come down to the arena and wrote a story about it.
Wait, really?
Yeah. I mean, he might have also.
You're just trying to take credit for the story.
It might have been someone else's tweet.
He said, "Did he say your tweet?"
He said that to me, but he might have told everyone he was talking to. That.
Look at you. You're owed something for this. Your tweets are changing humanity.
Yeah, that's going a bit.
And it's still not verified. It could have been anybody who tweeted that.
Should we talk more generally about Husky women's basketball?
Yeah, let's talk about especially what's to come.
Yeah, so they finished 15-3 in the Pac-12, tied for second place in the conference with Stanford, who wins the tiebreaker by virtue of having won at Hackett earlier this season. Oregon State ended up going 16-2, beat Stanford in a matchup with those teams on Friday night to win the conference
outright.
Oh, really?
So these were the three teams last year. Did Stanford advance to the Elite Eight last year?
They advanced the Elite Eight where they got beat by UW.
Okay, so there were three Pac-12 teams in the Elite Eight last year.
Yes.
And then all three of them are 1, 2, and 3 in the Pac-12 this year.
Yep. So Oregon State will be the number one seed in the Pac-12 tournament, which starts on Thursday. The top four teams will have byes. So the Huskies will first play on Friday, is a 3 seed, facing the winner of the Oregon-Arizona game. So a possible matchup if Arizona pulls the upset against former UW assistant Adia Barnes, who was crucial in recruiting the senior class and many of this year's, you know, many of the players on the team now.
She takes credit for Kelsey Plum like you take credit for that
very,
tweet.
Very much so.
From Matt Calkins' story. And then if they win that game, the most likely scenario would be to play Stanford again.
Yes, which would be a rematch of last year was actually a quarterfinal between those two teams where UW upset Stanford in the Pac-12 tournament before beating them again. I believe that was at Vanderbilt, Kentucky. It was at Kentucky for the
Didn't they
the
beat Kentucky
final.
There too?
I think Kentucky got upset before that, but I can't remember.
I thought they went into somebody's home field.
Well, Maryland they beat in Maryland in the first round. And this, you know, again, barring stumbling in the first round of the Pac-12 tournament, should be pretty safely in one of those top four protected seeds. That means they will play again at Heck Ed, hosting the first and second round of the NCAA tournament. So it takes a little of the luster off senior day in women's college basketball, knowing that you've got the chance to play at home again.
So this was Kelsey Plum's last time playing at Alaska Airlines Arena.
No, I'm saying it's not.
Oh, they'd play that at Heck Ed, not even Key Arena.
Yeah, no. Okay. It's a host.
Like they're going to play a lot more games in Seattle.
Yes, a number more games than Seattle. And then anyway, the other side of the bracket would be Oregon State. Presumably against UCLA would be the number four seed, the other team that gets a bye. That would likely be the semifinal on the other side. And Oregon State knocked off UW last year in the semifinals of the Pac-12 tournament. So should be an exciting weekend at Key Arena. I'm kind of bummed that I have to miss it because I'm going to be going out of town for the Sloan Conference. Usually those don't overlap, but this year they are. So I will be missing the excitement.
What does Sloan typically overlap with?
Typically, it overlaps with the last weekend of the Pac-12 women's season, I guess. So it's usually the weekend before this.
And you're going to give us a thorough review of the Sloan Conference next week?
The full panel-by-panel description, yes, of everything that's said.
Is there anything you're looking forward to at Sloan? Has it lost some of its luster? Is there a keynote?
I'm not sure who the biggest name speaking is. I mean, to me, it's not... The main thing I get out of there isn't really the panels. It's the opportunity to go and network with people, basically. Connect with people that you see once or twice a year throughout the league.
Shake some hands, kiss some babies.
Exactly.
Yeah, I completely understand. you don't know who the keynote is? It's Daryl Morey every year, right?
Well, Daryl is always prominently featured since he's one of the co-founders of the event. But, like, they'll have other people. I mean, it's like Michael Lewis, people like that.
Well, I hope that you come back next week with about basketball. New ways of looking at the sport.
Yes, that should all change. Billy Beane is doing it. I don't know if he's done it since I've been going to this.
Really?
Because usually there's not as prominent a baseball segment. Chris Collinsworth, he's a new one.
Oh. Okay. Can't wait to hear about it. Should we talk about Husky men's basketball?
Yeah, I suppose we should. Without Markelle Fultz tonight at Wazoo.
Those words are just like, maybe we should just not watch.
Yeah, probably shouldn't have. Kept it close most of the game, led, in fact, much of the second half before eventually struggling down the stretch and losing 79-71, getting swept by the Cougars for the first time since the 2011 conference season and losing their 10th consecutive game.
Still looking to crack double-digit victories here.
The Pac-12 regular season will mercifully come to an end next weekend.
I was hoping this was the last game.
At Wednesday at UCLA. Well, it'll be curious. That's the main curiosity, is whether Fultz will play on Wednesday at UCLA against Lonzo Ball or not. And my guess at this point would be no.
Why do you think that?
Lonzo Ball sounded pretty pessimistic in his post-game comments.
What happened? So he was injured, came back, injured again? Are they sitting him out? Is Markelle saying, like, yo, I'm going to be the first pick in the draft here?
I mean, everything Lorenzo Romer has said is that Fultz wants to play, and it's on the medical staff. And obviously, it's a sore knee. It's not like, you know, it's not like something where it's either injured or it's not. It's just kind of a matter of the symptoms and how he feels. So, you know, we'll see. But again, I'm not expecting him to play in that game. And I do think there is an element. I mean, I don't think this is going to be a factor in their decision making, but he's the number one guy right now.
Yeah.
In talking to people at the All-Star game, no one told me that anyone but Fultz was their number one pick.
He's pretty much reached the point of unanimous number one pick.
So Ball has a lot more to gain in that matchup than Fultz does, is the way I'd put it.
Okay.
So
to move from number two to number one, does he care that much?
Well, and apparently wherever the Lakers are drafting, that's where Lonzo Ball wants to be, according to his dad.
Okay.
Do you see that comment?
No. That sounds about right, though.
Originally said, like, he only wants to play for the Lakers, and then later clarified to say that, no, like, he wants him to play for the Lakers, but he'll play for other teams, I guess.
Okay. I kind of like the old school demanding what team you go to. Like, that doesn't happen that often anymore.
I'm still hoping for Kelsey Plum to do that with the Storm.
The Storm. There's only like four teams in the WNBA. She could do it pretty easily. Wait, Houston doesn't exist anymore, right?
They do not.
There's
12 teams. There's 12 teams. Anyways, then Saturday at USC will be the last regular season game, Pac-12 game for the Huskies. That potentially another matchup of top freshman point guards. DeAnthony Melton of USC, still pretty low on the draft boards, but in my statistical model, shines.
In your heart.
he had an excellent game against Fultz in Seattle earlier this year. So We'll see on that one.
So you rate D'Anthony Melton really well. Draft boards haven't caught up just yet?
Not yet, no.
Is he going to come out after his freshman season?
Probably not. I would assume he'll spend at least.
It's only UW point guards who come out after their...
Get blown up really high on draft boards. I mean, Fultz obviously was
awesome. That's a different scenario, but I'm sure he'll stick around and develop his skills during a sophomore season while everybody from UW leaves.
I don't know if we talked about this when we previewed that game earlier, but he's basically like if Gary Payton II had played 4 years in college or had come into college as a freshman. That's what D'Anthony Melton is.
He's Gary Payton II as a senior, as a freshman.
He's not, no. But he's like what Gary Payton II probably would have been if he were a freshman.
Okay. So I have no idea what you're saying.
So, like, if you project, like, go backwards on Gary Payton's development curve from how amazing he was as a senior to what he would have been like as a freshman.
Well, did he come in as a transfer?
He was a JC transfer.
Okay.
He only played 2 years at Oregon State, so that's why I say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Which he must have been a really good JC player. Considering he was maybe the best, one of the top two or three players in the Pac-12 last year.
When we look forward to the conclusion of the Husky basketball season.
Can't possibly come soon enough.
Let's just get all this out of the way. Let's talk about the most important thing to talk about. Kelsey Plum, that's great. Right? Great performance. Maybe the best basketball player that we've ever seen in Seattle history. But there's something more important than Kelsey Plum. More important than your complicated description of D'Anthony Melton versus Gary Payton II.
Is that burgers?
Can you turn around for a second?
All right.
I have something to show you here.
This is the secret surprise?
Just getting myself ready here for Burger Talk. You see what it is?
I'm fascinated.
Oh, it's the hat! Oh!
Burger hat!
Oh! This is the burger hat that I will be wearing every week when we talk about burgers.
Wow, congratulations.
Oh, handshake, we're shaking. Yes, I don't think we've ever shook hands on the podcast before.
A toast.
That's a
lot of commitment right there.
I committed myself to it 4 weeks in a row to go and get Lil Woody's burgers.
Wow, the sacrifice.
Do you want to know what? Just to demonstrate my grit to you.
Yeah, this has been a very grit-heavy podcast, apparently.
I faced a bit of an obstacle on week 4.
What was that?
So the first 3 weeks, I went, had the burgers. They were great, right?
Yeah.
Week 4, looked at the website, saw what the burger was, and saw that burger had pistachios in it.
Oh, no.
Which is one of pistachios and cashews, which I'm very allergic to. So I was like, F it. I'm not having this burger. Everything sucks. It's pouring rain. I hate Seattle. I hate everything. Threw my hat on the ground that I didn't have yet.
Your metaphorical hat?
My metaphorical hat. But then I decided to call up Lil Woody's to ask them if I could get it without the pistachios, which they said no. Oh. It was part of a tapenade, right? And then I was like, look, weird question. But I've been working on eating each of the Burger Month burgers to get to the hat. Can I just get a different burger and get the hat? And they said, of course. We wouldn't want you to have worked that long and not get the hat. So I went up there, got the big... He was like, how long... When are you coming? And I was like, right this second. I work very close to the Lil Woody's. But he was like, okay, cool. I'm right here. So I walk up there. Tell the dude it's clearly a different dude, right? Because the person who I'm talking to is very grizzled. And the person who actually was at the register was nowhere near as grizzled.
They would have lost SNL, hey. Who's more grizzled?
Yes. I'm like, hey, the dude told me I could get this burger. I'm allergic to this other thing, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I don't know about that. Clearly puzzled. And then so I had to find the other guy. Like, I had to go through a lot of things to get to this hat.
That is amazing, Chris.
I had to find the other guy. I'd be like, hey, I just talked to you on the phone. You said I could get the hat if I got another burger. Like, we've talked about this.
You know, I've still got Angela Duckworth's email. Would you like me to email her and, like, suggest you as a paragon of grit for future books?
Be like, and then he found out in week 4 that the burger had pistachios.
He had to talk to people.
he had to talk to somebody on the phone and in person.
That's the most horrifying.
And like the idea that grit is like told through NFL films.
Or it's a little bit like who they kept it realer?
The frozen tundra of low woodies.
It's a little bit like when keeping it real goes wrong.
Look at this hat, though. Isn't this great?
Yeah, that was worth the effort.
Right?
Especially just, when, because we're going to talk about burgers on a regular basis.
I mean, I was trying to find a way to, I was going to take a picture of myself wearing it like Chance the Rapper on the coloring book cover. Right? Because the hat is like the most prominent thing on the coloring book cover, right?
Yeah.
So I was trying to find a way to take, and for some reason that didn't come to fruition.
Well, there's still time. Maybe that could be, I've been looking for like, we're putting together a web page on soniccentral.com/peltoncast that will keep our reviews of these burgers as we go through them, and then links to the websites and everything to facilitate, because it's a guide to burgers. That's what this ultimately is.
Oh, it's a guide. Not a bracket, guide. Yeah. I like that.
And it also, this, well, sometimes I call it a guide. Sometimes I call it the quest for Seattle's best burger, or the search for Seattle's
best
burger.
How often are you talking to this? Who are you saying this to?
You know, people.
Just me at various different times.
Yes. Anyways, that could be a photo for the top of that page.
I like that. But another way that I had a lot of grit in this burger scenario, right, is this happened the day after. I'm describing having burgers two consecutive days is great. This happened the day after we ate at, Lil Woody's is also on the list, but we'll have that later. We ate at our first burger place in the quest for Seattle's best burger.
The first of what is now 17, because we've added Lunchback Box Laboratory to the list after popular demand.
Maybe 18. I think we added a second one. Oh, I added Giddy Up Burgers in Freelard.
Okay.
So 18 burgers. And we went to, for week one, Takatsu Burger. Both our first time ever, right?
Yeah, which is a place that we've been wanting to go for a long period of time and just had never kind of been, like, made it happen. Because it's weird. It's like, you know, 10 minutes away from my house. It's actually a very convenient location for me, but still had never been there.
It's the most convenient of any of the burger locations.
So the idea of Katsu Burgers is the name suggests, it's burgers done katsu style.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which I was expecting, like, a thicker, more noticeable breading, I guess, katsu breading. It really wasn't that, you know, it wasn't overwhelming. It was just kind of enough to give the burger a little bit of a crunch. What, you disagree?
No, I mean, I don't disagree. I just...
Why were you making that face?
I'm not that impressed.
Yeah, that's fair.
I was expecting this to be something completely out of the ordinary, right? But it was more or less just a burger. It was a good burger. It was well done. And maybe the katsu on the patty added a little bit of extra flavor, but it just wasn't enough for me.
I would say, to me, the noticeable thing was the burger patty did not have much flavor. And I don't know how much I was thrown off here by the fact that I didn't add cheddar cheese, as you did to your order.
I mean, I don't think that the cheddar cheese would have made the burger patty taste all that different.
I don't know. So I had the Samurai Select, which is... had pineapple and bacon on top, along with wasabi mayo and tonkatsu sauce. Not very noticeable, the katsu sauce. I would say the wasabi mayo was kind of the most flavorful thing of this entire burger to me.
Do you have... So we're going to be rating these on a scale of 0 to 100.
And you had... What did you have here?
I'm looking that up. That's what I was asking you.
Well,
you
had the classic.
I had basically the classic katsu burger and then added...
Bacon and cheese.
Bacon and cheese to that. You know, just to liven it up. And also, bacon's great.
Yeah. The bacon was pretty good. Yeah. Anyways, did I have a rating for this? I did. And that rating was 82.
Okay, so... I started out with a rating. Honestly, the Lil Woody's burger the next day made me retroactively go back and lower my score.
Oh, wow.
For the katsu burger the previous day.
Wow.
Look, I don't want to spoil anything for when we actually have Lil Woody's when we're reviewing it, but having another burger the next day, which granted, I had a lot of burgers this last week because BTS behind the scenes, we had, because you're going to Boston, a second burger place, which we'll discuss next week on the podcast.
You don't want to share what that burger place was?
Can't.
Okay.
Could not.
It's as much of a secret as the hat was to me.
That was pretty good, right?
It was good. It was funny. So your
if son, you ever see me in person, I'm going to be wearing this hat because I've worn it basically every day since I had it.
It's replaced the other one hat you used to wear constantly.
I've gotten like 5 new hats this year.
Your eldest son, baby fantasy genius.
He kept whispering to me throughout the day about it. And he was like, "Dad, when we pull out the hat, I'll be sitting on the couch. Don't tell Al, okay?" And I'm like, okay, I'm not unveiling the hat today. It'll be weeks from now. I was thinking that he'd come in and be like, and then the burger hat.
But he did manage to keep
it. I protected this burger hat like it was the nuclear codes.
Well, hopefully better than that.
So anyway,
all right, what was your grade?
Or your giving rating? It a 76.
76. We still have no context for what these scores will be out of. So I'm curious to see where these are going to land.
Not good. Not good.
76 doesn't sound that good, especially the fact that you retro. What did you have it before you read?
I actually had it as an 85 before.
Really?
Wow, which I thought maybe an 85 was like a negative review. But then I thought to myself, look, an 85 is a solid B, right?
Yes.
I was channeling your trade grades and thinking to myself, I don't want to give everything like a B up, right? I don't want to be parsing like, oh, this was a 96 versus a 97 burger.
So you don't want to grade inflate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, we don't want to be ratebeer.com. We want to be beeradvocate.com.
Absolutely. So speaking of trade grades.
Oh. Are we done with burgers?
I think we are.
Can we after we review the burgers, you're going to be adding them to the Peltoncast website.
Yes.
With photos of the burgers that we
ate. Oh, yeah. I didn't mention that. Yeah, photos. And then you'll link to the actual review and link to the website for the burger and everything like that.
Okay.
And so at this point, we're not going to put the ratings on that page until we're done with all of them. And then they'll be in order.
Oh, we're not?
So we're going to keep a little suspense here.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Okay.
I learned it from the Young Pope.
That was superfluous. Superfluous reference.
But I checked off that bingo score.
Okay.
So speaking of my trade grades, you had an interesting idea that you shared with me last week on Twitter.
And what was that?
I thought you were going
to explain. I was going to preface it.
Yeah.
So, okay, I talked to you. I was like, I have something to show you. I have something to show you on Twitter. And the thing that I actually had to show you was the burger hat.
Okay.
Just to let you know, nothing else is coming.
FYI.
It's just that I have a hat with a burger on it. But I had the idea. I was driving around listening to Bill Simmons on a 4-man pod with my boy, Chris Ryan.
Yes.
Basically, it's a 2-man pod to me. It's Bill Simmons and Chris Ryan. And had the thought that maybe...
Wait, are you cutting out Joe House?
Okay, House.
How dare you?
Look, everybody was good.
Aspirationally, one of my Wizards. I like that
he said that. My friends from DC are you and aspirationally Joe has. I thought that was pretty funny. I had the idea that maybe we should go back and try to look at, because they were talking about like how we would have viewed the horrendous Celtics Nets trade that led to the Celtics being both a good team and having all of the best draft picks for the next 2 years.
Yes.
Well, 3 years straight, basically.
I mean, I don't know. It led to them being a good team. It led to them having all the good draft picks despite becoming a good team. Let's put it that way.
And I was curious, like, what the grade would have been at the time for that trade. You actually did a grade for that and were way off.
Way off. Rated the Nets a B- on it. Thought they were going to be able to rebuild on the fly so those picks would never be that good and that the Celtics wouldn't be able to swap with them. Whoops.
And now you would grade that. If you were giving retroactive grades, you'd give that an F. Do you give F minuses?
No, because there is no F plus, there is no F minus. There is only an F.
Okay.
Well, you fail or you don't. That's it.
Okay.
You don't kind of fail. You either fail or you don't.
Harsh but fair. So I was curious, if we can look back on the most important trades in Sonic's history, especially the ones that affected us the most.
Yeah, we're not going to go back to the
Lenny Wilkins was traded, Tom Chambers.
There were some really bad trades if we want to go back far enough. I was thinking of Marvin Webster when he went to the Knicks and his compensation. The Sonics ended up with
a horse.
Lonnie.
That's what people were trading players for at the time, right?
Oh, they ended up with Lonnie. They ended up with Lonnie Shelton, who then was a part of the championship team.
Oh, it was a good trade.
Yeah. And okay. then That was a good one. The Lenny Wilkins trade, not so much.
There were trades at the time that involved cattle, though, right?
No. That's horrible.
Baseball, this didn't happen?
Maybe in baseball.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, we're not going that far back. You mentioned two trades. Obviously, the Sean Kemp three-team trade for Vin Baker. And then the trade that was headlined by Ray Allen and Gary Payton. Where do you want to start here?
Let's start with Sean Kemp, because that was the oldest one. Can you walk us through every single player who was involved?
I can, absolutely. So the Sonics, for the Sonics, it was basically a one-for-one
swap. Are you writing about this for ESPN Insider?
Not imminently, but it may happen at some point. Okay. And not necessarily these trades.
You might write about superstar trade grades.
Yeah. So the Sonics, essentially, for them, it was a one-for-one swap, Kemp for Baker. Kemp went to Cleveland. So did Sherman Douglas from Milwaukee. And then the Cavaliers sent to Milwaukee Terrell Brandon, Tyrone Hill, and their 1998 first-round pick.
Okay.
So,
do you know who that turned out to be? Bobby Surra?
No. I mean,
Milwaukee got it.
Yes, it was someone Milwaukee drafted. So let's start with the Sonics' perspective. I would have graded them a B for this trade.
Okay.
Because they, you know, obviously the situation was Kemp wanted out. He was very unhappy about his contract. He had become unreliable during that final season in Seattle. He wasn't as productive as the year before.
He was unreliable during that final season?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, he had issues with tardiness throughout his Sonics career.
He was still good on the court, though, right?
He was good, but not as good as he was in 96. He had 11 warp that season. Vin Baker that year had 10.5 warp for Milwaukee after having about 6 the previous 2 years. And so he was younger.
Yeah, he was younger.
He was 25 at the time, you know, just starting to come into his prime. Kemp was 27, had, as it turned out, a lot of mileage because of the fact that he came into the NBA so early out of college, after not really playing in college. And, you know, from that standpoint, I think you would have felt that. So
why is this only a B then?
Well, because Kemp is still a better player, I think, than Baker would have been. And they had Kemp, you know, like part of this from Cleveland's standpoint is they ended up renegotiating his contract to make Kemp happy and paying him a ton of money. But from the Sonic standpoint, his contract was actually quite favorable. Baker had 2 years left at about $4 million apiece on his deal. So it was pretty good. But like you're basically getting an equivalent player, just someone who's happier. So, like, if you get an equivalent player, that should be a C. But the fact that, you know, that you needed to trade Kemp, to me, made it a B. Okay.
What would you have rated it retroactively? Like, how did Sean Kemp do? This is the weird question that I have, is it's almost like, I feel like this happens when players are traded away from Seattle. If you take any of the superstars who are not Randy Johnson, who are traded away from Seattle, it's almost like they go into this abyss, right? Where I cannot almost even visualize Sean Kemp playing for Cleveland or playing for Orlando.
Yeah, whoever heard of Alex Rodriguez after he left Seattle?
Yeah, what is that guy doing? I think he's a pretty good broadcaster. but Alex Rodriguez wasn't traded, first off.
He wasn't, no.
But, like, honestly, like, Ken Griffey Jr., when he went to Cincinnati, do you have any memories of Ken Griffey Jr. in Cincinnati or Atlanta?
No, I mean, the same commonality being that, A, they were both past their prime, and B, they were both on bad teams. But the thing about Kemp is, like, everyone thinks he got fat after the lockout, as Baker was out of shape after the lockout and was never the same player. But he actually had a pretty good year the lockout season in Cleveland. It was the next year after he got traded to Portland that he really fell off a cliff.
But Sean Kemp basically had two good years left in him.
Yes. Which was one more than Baker, as it turned out, had left in him. But Kemp, that first year in Cleveland, they went essentially with, they started four rookies in Sean Kemp. They started Brevin Knight at point guard. Zdunas Ilgauskas was at center.
Oh, Big Z.
Cedric Henderson. And I forget who the other guy was. Maybe it was only three rookies in Kemp. But it was a really extraordinarily young team, partially because of the fact that they traded two starters to get one in this trade. They also got Sherman Douglas.
Yeah, how would you have rated it for the other teams?
So I would have rated a D minus for Cleveland.
Oh, no.
So Brandon was awesome in Cleveland. He was like one of the NBA's best point guards. It was likely he was going to regress a little bit, but and he was on a great contract. He was making about $1 million that year in the final year of his contract. Tyrone Hill was making $4 million in the last year of his contract, a similar amount to what Kemp was due to make, but they immediately renegotiated him up to $8.6 million at the start of the massive contract that he never even saw all the way out because of the fact that he ended up getting waived by the Blazers.
Sean Kemp.
Yeah. And so for the privilege of paying Kemp way more money to be not quite as good as Terrell Brandon, they gave up a first round pick in Tyrone Hill.
Wow.
Like, that doesn't make any sense. Sherman Douglas was kind of dead salary. He was also making around $4 million, was still like a decent backup point guard, but was not really a starter caliber. And they ended up trading him in training camp that year because they saw that Brevin Knight could be the starter. So this was a really bad trade for the Cavs. They had a good year that first season with Kemp. They unexpectedly made the playoffs, went 47-35 that year. Derek Anderson, by the way, was the other rookie starter. They did have four. But
that's kind of amazing. They had Sean Kemp and four rookie starters.
It is really crazy. And Kemp was awesome that first year in Cleveland. But it all fell apart after that. Ilgauskas got injured. The next, they won 22-28 the lockout season, 32-50, 30-52, 29-53, 17-65. And then they draft LeBron.
Yeah. So really what you're saying is that trade set them up to get LeBron.
Yeah, I guess you could look at it. That's a really
optimistic. It's an A-plus if you think about it long-term enough.
anyway, so Milwaukee, I think, actually did pretty well here. I gave them an A-. Brandon, you know, was about equivalent, I think, in value to Vin Baker. Vin Baker had 2 years left in his contract to just one for Brandon, but they were similar caliber players at that point. And then also they balanced it out positionally because they got Tyrone Hill. And they got the first round pick, which I think at that point going into the season, you would have expected would have been a lottery pick. It ended up being 17th. They drafted Pat Garrity and ended up trading him on draft night as part of the, I believe as part of the Dirk Nowitzki Robert Traylor trade, which that one didn't work out super great for them. But
how would you have rated that at the time?
I mean, no one would have known at the time how poorly that was going to turn out. But I actually think Milwaukee got the best end of that deal.
So really, looking at this trade, it's kind of amazing that I'm rationalizing 1996 right now. But I don't know if I remember hating it when it happened. Obviously, I hated it in as much as that I loved Sean Kemp. I love Sean Kemp only as much as a 10-year-old could love Sean Kemp.
But
you know,
we knew Sean Kemp was getting traded. It was just a matter of where and for whom.
I don't know if I knew that.
I don't know. I knew that.
Look, I was 10. I didn't know that much. I wasn't an ESPN insider.
I remember where I was when that trade got announced. It was during an episode of Friends.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't remember this at all.
Thursday night.
I remember being a lot of trades. I remember mostly only Mariners trade deadline trades.
We should. That could be a fun podcast episode. Remember where we were when trades got announced.
There are a lot of those. Jose Cruz Jr. getting traded. Still probably the most devastating trade of my entire life.
I've gone back and looked at that recently to see if Cruz was actually as good a prospect as we thought. And the answer is probably not, but it was still a bad trade. Anyways, the other thing I looked
I've
up...
I've never been more devastated about a trade happening.
The other thing I looked up with this one is... the other guy the Sonics were linked to repeatedly was Antonio McDyess from Denver.
Oh, yeah. I remember actually, I think, wanting Antonio McDyess.
Same.
Always liked him.
But retroactively, like, McDyess turned out to be a pretty good player, but it would have been a horrible trade. Like, he hadn't been that good yet in his career. He had, like, 0.6 warp the previous season.
Really?
And then he only had 1 year left on his contract before becoming a free agent, and then he ended up, in fact, leaving Denver and signing with Phoenix.
But so the Sonics took somebody who is about to fall off a cliff. Granted, the lockout, I think, affected everybody.
Yes.
The lockout, we only think of the lockout affecting Vin Baker, right?
I think of it affecting Kemp, too.
But we didn't see it in the same way.
Actually, I'm sorry. He signed with Phoenix, and he was traded to Phoenix McDyess, and then subsequently signed as a free agent, went back to Denver. Worked out very well for the Nuggets.
But we don't think of it of... affecting Sean Kemp in the same way that we think of it affecting Vin Baker because we weren't seeing it on a day-to-day basis, right?
I feel like it did. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
But let's
to me, the two, like, when you think of as an NBA fan, hey, what were the effects of the lockout? The two players,
Vin Baker and Sean Kemp. Terrell Brandon was fine.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of issues with his weight. But he also left pretty quickly. He got traded the next season as part of the Sam Cassell Stephon Marbury three-team trade.
But if the lockout doesn't happen, Vin Baker would have been playing at a pretty high level for much longer than Sean Kemp was.
You would expect so. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, his skills might have aged relatively quickly, but yeah, that first season in Seattle, he was, you know, one of the top probably 15 to 20 players in the league.
Man. Okay, so I'm still upset about the lockout season. It was basically the lockout was the beginning of the end for the Sonics.
Yep. Yeah, no, it was.
It was that era, which is the most important team of our childhood, started declining severely after the lockout.
I mean, it was inevitable. Given the age of the team, it was inevitable they were going to start declining. But the Vin Baker thing came out of nowhere.
Well, okay, so then...
He went from, like, 11 wins above replacement in his first season in Seattle to below replacement level after the lockout.
That's insane.
I don't know how unprecedented that is historically, but it's got to be up there.
Okay, and then so another trade, which I'm hoping you would have graded good at the time, but was the Gary Payton for Ray Allen swap.
All right, so my grades for this, an A for the Sonics and a D for the Bucks.
Oh, man.
And I considered an F for the Bucks. Like, this was obviously an awful trade at the time. Now, the context here is that we love Gary Payton, obviously.
Of course.
A couple years earlier, as a freshman at UW, I had started a website devoted...
Oh, my God.
...called Keep Gary Payton.
Keep GP.
And then later Extend GP, devoted to the idea of...
Nobody remembers Gary Payton, the Extend GP part.
You know, it wasn't quite as catchy as Keep GP.
This was written about in the Seattle Times.
Seattle PI.
Oh, it was the PI? Yeah. I was going to say pre when your tweets were affecting stories that Matt Galkins or whatever was writing.
That's true. We handed out flyers at, like, these open houses the Sonics were holding that season. So clearly,
is keepgp.com, is that still?
I'm not sure.
Do you still own that? It's probably in Katie's name.
Well, we never had the website. It's like on, like, basically the equivalent of, you know, like a
media fire or something.
Yes,
angel fire. It's keepgp.angelfire.net.
It's keepgp.adom.com. So I don't know. I think it might link to a dead page at this point. I'm looking it up. No, that site stopped existing years ago. Okay. It does not. Okay. You can find some of those. I can find some of those web pages. So on. Anyways, so obviously I always opposed the idea of trading Gary Payton. But I got to be honest, after the initial shock of that trade wore off.
Yes.
And I didn't see it coming, even though I was working for the Sonics as an intern at the time. Like, the story of that day, the trade deadline was, you know, I was at the office until noon. And then I had to go back to campus to go to class at UW. I went back, took the bus, like there was no smartphones. I had no idea there was a trade until I checked sonicscentral.com between classes that day and saw that it was crashed. So until I knew there was a trade.
That was your website.
Yeah.
Your website was crashed, but had no news about Gary Payton. Or did somebody else?
Supersonics.com would have been what would have had news. But yeah.
Okay.
So anyways, this was shocking, but
yes,
you traded Payton, who at the time
what is every member of this trade? Because I only remember Ray Allen and Gary Payton.
Okay, so the Sonics traded Payton and Desmond Mason. we'll get to that. The Sonics traded Gary Payton and Desmond Mason.
Still miss you, Desmond.
We'll get to that. For Ray Allen, Flip Murray, Kevin Ollie, and Milwaukee's first round draft pick.
Who turned out to be?
Luke Ridenour.
Not bad. They got a first round pick out of that?
Yeah, that... What? All right, so let's go through this trade. So Payton at this point is 34 years old. And in the last season of his contract, he was 34 in the last season of his contract.
I feel like people were so, every GM was so stupid before, like, what year? What year did it change when GMs were like, maybe we should think a little bit before making these trades?
Probably not until like 2008, honestly. Maybe 2009.
That's insane.
Like, even Sam Presti's first year, he was taking advantage of this. So they traded that
guy. No, Sam Presti was like years ahead for 1 year, right?
A couple years. So they traded that guy for Ray Allen, who was 27, one of the top 10 to 15 players in the league, and had 2 years left on his contract beyond the current season.
How did they do this?
George Karl.
George Karl? Like, thanks, George Karl, though. Like,
he drove this trade. He loved Gary Payton, hated Ray Allen, and it was one of the worst trades you could possibly make. Because not only did they make this terrible one-for-one trade, like, they had to get Desmond Mason, who, hate to be honest with you, and I know this is going to make our cousin very unhappy, not that good a player.
Oh, Desmond. Look, if he would have stayed in Seattle, he would have been a superstar.
This is one of two seasons in his career he rated above replacement player by WARP.
Really?
He was better in real plus minus going back, running that retroactively. Like, he was almost league average, but still to get a first round pick for him was actually pretty good.
Where did and he then rate also, in winning the dunk contest?
Very high. And then also Flip Murray, like, was a lotto ticket who had his 15 minutes of fame for the Sonics.
Flip Murray.
Ray Allen was injured the next year. And Kevin Ollie was actually a useful backup point guard for them for a half season.
Maybe an okay head coach, too.
He won the championship. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
So basically, Milwaukee had no justification whatsoever in making this trade.
Okay, so
and it was a no-brainer for the Sonics.
The thing that was amazing about it, right? I think, first off, probably when George Karl approached... This was Wally, who was running the team. Was it Rick Sund?
Rick Sund, yeah.
Both of them were there.
Is the president. But.
When they approached them and they were like, so do you want to flip Ray Allen for Gary Payton? They probably at first were like, ooh, I don't know. But then they thought about it for a second and were like, wait a minute. What is he proposing here?
So some of the reporting, I haven't actually done any like personal digging on this one, but the reporting was these two teams had been talking about the framework of a Ray Allen-Gary Payton trade dating back to the draft the previous year.
Really?
So like,
because George Karl is just desperate for Gary Payton.
These were ongoing conversations.
And he led them that season to the Eastern Conference Finals, right?
No, they lost in the first round.
Oh, really?
What are you talking about? They were the eighth seed.
Wait, like, went to the Eastern Conference Finals at some point.
Yeah, with Ray Allen.
With Ray Allen.
Because he was really good.
Yeah.
That was 2 years earlier. They went with Ray Allen and lost to Allen Iverson and the Sixers in a series that...
Yeah, with Ray Allen. He's in a movie and his name is Jesus.
They had Gary Payton for 2 months. They lost in the first round of the playoffs. And then he signed with the Lakers. Like, this was a terrible trade.
That is such a bad trade. Okay, so do you remember a few things? Everybody had these knee-jerk reactions, right? Because we loved Sean Kemp, and we especially loved Gary Payton.
Yes. I mean, to me, Kemp more than Payton. I don't know how you feel on that.
I think that's probably true, but Payton was here longer.
For most Sonics fans, Payton ahead of Kemp.
It's complicated to parse between the two. We love both of them equally. But... there was this knee-jerk reaction among Sonics fans. Look, the people who had season tickets next to us, starting in 1995-96 on, got rid of their season tickets at that point. That was it. They were done. If you're trading 34-year-old Gary Payton for 27-year-old Ray Allen, we're out. That's what they said.
You remember there was the trade Wally banner at the next game?
A trade Wally banner.
Yeah, someone right. Like it was like a plane flying overhead like, with trade Wally.
The fans needed your trade grades for them to rationalize
really
this.
Did. And the funny thing is, like, the fact that I was working for the team meant that I couldn't explain to people what an amazing trade this was because
that
I had to, like...
It seems like that you should have been doing that.
But I would have looked too biased if I would have said it, is what I'm saying here.
I think I remember you telling me that it was a good trade and me just determining that that was, like, I agreed with that. I don't know if you felt that strongly about it because we all felt like... It sucks seeing Gary Payton go. Okay, but
part of the reason that they were willing to make the trade at this point and didn't make it back at the draft, I mean, who knows exactly what the parameters were.
They probably should have done
it. Because the team
too.
Was like falling apart at that point and was clearly not going to make the playoffs.
But
suddenly needed to get younger.
Do you remember there was a Steve Kelly story?
Yes.
The next day where he said that Gary Payton would be in the league longer than Ray Allen.
I don't think he said for sure he would be. He suggested it was a possibility.
I mean, even throwing it out there.
I know.
Ray Allen, to this day, in the year 2000, what year did this trade happen?
This happened 14 years ago.
Ray Allen, to this day, could still be playing if he wanted to.
Yes.
If Ray Allen was like, hey, Cleveland, I'm looking to come back into basketball, they'd be like, boom, signed, right? They wouldn't even hesitate. He could play for the Clippers. He could maybe play for the Warriors. He could play for the Cavs. He could be playing for a team that...
He probably couldn't play for the Cavs now. They needed to fill Darren Williams and Andrew Bogut's spot.
Well, they've got Kyle Korver. They don't need Ray Allen right now.
They don't.
But Ray Allen could play for a NBA title competitor in the year 2017, and Gary Payton ain't walking through that door.
Gary Payton, he was at the All-Star weekend at the Hall of Fame press conference, indicated that he does not plan to play in the three-on-three league that's starting up this
summer.
That's
where Gary Payton's at.
He's coaching instead. He's done playing.
His children are in the NBA now.
Well, not, but close.
It was, yeah. Such an amazing tray.
Steve Kelly's a dear friend, but boy, that was an there was a lot of exceptionally bad takes about the trade, and that one probably took the cake.
That was the worst take. And really, I mean, that trade extended the Sonics. They didn't really have like a championship run after that, but it extended their window.
Which, for better or worse, I mean, they probably would have rebuilt completely otherwise. And, you know, there was a brief period.
I mean, okay, let's just...
A brief period that season where you ran the LeBron watch on SonicCentral.com. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
And people really wanted Darko at that point.
Wait, what pick did the... That was when the Sonics ended up with Nick Collison and Luke Grinard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which was a pretty good haul, all things considered. No,
but they were not that close to getting LeBron.
No.
But... It kept their window open. And honestly, if you project it out and just give them the Thunder years that happened, which all of this time period set up, right?
Yeah.
Like that period from 95 through 2016 when Kevin Durant leaves, and even still now, they're still a relevant team, is like a pretty impressive time period for an NBA franchise.
It is.
Most franchises, they... go through much longer periods of irrelevance or periods where they have no real shot of winning a championship. And that franchise, through that time period, has like 12 seasons in there where they could have won the championship.
Yep.
Now, thank God they didn't for a lot of those years. But what that set up, and it also gave us, to me, my favorite NBA season that I ever experienced, which was the 2004 NBA season.
Yeah, 2004-05.
And we'll talk about that in the future, right? But that was like, that was the season to me that this trade set up, which was my favorite NBA season, my favorite team to watch of any NBA team there was.
Yep. All right. Well, that was a fun trip down memory lane.
What a good trade.
It really was.
It's so insane. I just think the idea of trading, like having a superstar, I didn't realize he was that old. Because you talk about superstars now and you're like, he's 29. You're like, he doesn't have much left in the tank.
I'm telling you, yeah. Just things are so dramatic.
34 with it, and it, the last year of his contract. That is insane.
I feel like I wrote something about that trade at some point and how great it was. But I don't know.
Would the Sonics have re-signed Gary Payton had they not made that trade?
Maybe. I don't know. Huh. Like he would have demanded like a max deal, and they probably would have balked at that, and maybe he would have gone to LA.
So the same thing would have happened.
I don't know. Who knows?
Okay. All right, let's talk about some current sports.
We'll round up quickly. First, on the Sonics arena, Mayor Ed Murray has created an arena advisory panel that he announced last week, I guess this now is, that includes, among others, Lenny Wilkins.
Is this arena advisory panel, which first off, I really don't like the idea of former players being on things like this. It's like, what... I would rather have city planners be on these advisory panels.
Well, this is supposed to be like a private citizen thing or like an industry leader type thing. So, you know, for example, the other people who are on this committee include Ethan Stoll of Ethan Stoll Restaurants.
What?
Megan Jasper, the CEO of Sub
Pop. Megan Jasper's on the advisory panel?
These are just like people.
This is an insane advisory panel. Look, I love Megan Jasper. This is not a question about Megan Jasper, but
there's a three-pronged approach. The community advisory panel.
I had no idea that Megan was on this panel.
The city staff review team and the executive review team. So those are the people who are providing the insight from the pragmatic city government level. These people are supposed to be providing the civic level. And so it's a variety of people like this. It also includes the head of the Uptown Alliance, Deborah Frosto. So if you thought this was going to be, my concern would be that this would be just basically a rubber stamp panel that the mayor had put together because obviously he favors the Key Arena site.
This is supposed to be a pro-Key Arena panel.
But I think there is going to be some skepticism here.
Based upon what?
Based upon the fact that I don't think people who live in Queen Anne want the arena to be in Queen Anne.
Okay.
So that's what the Uptown Alliance is. Uptown is growing into an urban walkable neighborhood, Frosto said. People who live here love that they are within walking distance of so many arts and entertainment options that help define Seattle. I will pay close attention to proposals that demonstrate they understand this vision of our neighborhood while addressing the transportation needs for those who want to enjoy events at Key Arena. So, I mean, that's not... I don't think that's like a really pro standpoint.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Consider me a little bit skeptical there.
All right. Maybe I'm being naive here. I just don't think it's the rubber stamp panel I expected.
Okay. Based upon what?
Based upon the fact that, I think Lenny Wilkins is going to be realistic about what it's actually going to take to make Key Arena viable, since he did work for the team for a year.
When?
When Clay Bennett owned it.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. He was not, you'll recall, interested in renovating Key Arena.
Let's go on to something else. I don't like this. This seems like something that they're doing, putting public faces together to try to curry public interest into continuing a Key Arena conversation.
I mean, the important thing is it's not like all the Port of Seattle on the board, which obviously has been
very publicly against the Soto Arena. I guess so, but this is almost worse, though. The Port of Seattle, you can say, like, okay, clearly these people are biased, right? But this is a panel of like, oh, I really like Ethan Stoll's restaurants. Oh, Lenny Wilkins, Sonic's legend.
I mean, who knows what Ethan Stoll's view on this issue is, but I don't
obviously you don't know what Ethan Stoll's view on this issue is, but I know, because why would you know what Ethan Stoll's view on this issue is?
But I know what the head of the Uptown Alliance's view of, which is not in my backyard, because that's the view of any person about anything that could possibly happen anywhere in Seattle, is always not in my backyard. You can apply that to any
Soto is nobody's thing. Backyard. It's just the Port of Seattle's backyard.
Yeah, it's the ports. So that's they're the ones who are NIMBYs there in the Mariners. It's down the street. It's not going house. We've been over it. Husky football. Okay. According to the Denver Post, UW offensive line coach Chris Strausser will be hired by the Broncos as an assistant offensive line coach. So another defection from the Husky coaching staff this offseason.
Yep. I don't like. Okay. I mean, that's what's going to happen. They're a good team. We're talking about position coaches versus coordinators. It's always fine.
It's always disappointing when you lose this kind of experience and part of the staff. But the key thing here is Chris Peterson has a lot of experience losing staff and seeing them take better jobs based on his time in Boise State and the success they had there. So, you know, I think this is part of the process.
I wonder what Ethan Stoll has to say about it.
Seahawks?
Yeah.
The big news of the last week, the Seahawks have gotten two compensatory picks in the third round. By the way, this relates to the Broncos offensive line, because the reason this happened is because the NFL ruled that Russell Okung's entire contract counted for the Seahawks in terms of the compensatory picks, even though the Broncos, as expected, waived him and made him a free
agent. Don't say it was a terrible contract. It was good for somebody, and that is the Seattle Seahawks. Are we toasting to this? Yeah. It's like...
So, third
round picks. They had three third round picks last season.
Yes.
And what, three this season? To me, I look at those players. In the third round last year, they drafted CJ Procise,
yes,
who unfortunately didn't play for this full season, but when he did play, looked like maybe one of the most promising rookies we've seen in years, right?
You know, played a key role in winning the game at New England. Again, the only team to beat New England with Tom Brady.
Yeah, let's mention that a lot. Look, we got a lot of months to mention that. Reese Odhiambo, who at this point we don't know exactly what it'll look like, but at the very least, depth offensive lineman.
Hopefully,
and
yeah.
Nick Vinette, who seems like he makes Luke Wilson a little bit more expendable.
Yes, I think that's a reasonable position. Didn't play much as a rookie.
And do you know who else was a third round pick?
Who was?
Number three.
Oh, Russell Wilson?
Yeah. The most important player in franchise history.
I don't think the Seahawks are going to draft a quarterback or Russell Wilson.
They're probably more likely to draft a punter, but...
A kicker in this case. Seahawks with five now of the first 106 picks in the draft.
But you give Pete and John picks in that range, and there's a good chance that they're going to find something interesting.
I'm hoping at some point Barnwell will write a piece about like the value of each team's draft or like the extra picks they have, because I'm curious now where the Seahawks rate in that. All right, the other bit of Seahawks-related news from the last week is that defensive tackle Earl Mitchell, who visited the Seahawks last week, we discussed the discrepancy between his tremendous spark score and his middling production thus far in the NFL, after visiting with a couple other teams, including Denver apparently, signed with the San Francisco 49ers for 4 years and $16 million, including $5.5 million this season.
I wonder if GM John Lynch just had some money and wanted to spend it.
They definitely have some money. I think they have the most cap space in the NFL.
It's almost like that ain't solving your problems in San Francisco.
No. I mean, that's for the role he probably would have played in Seattle, that's probably too much money.
Yes.
So not a huge loss here, but We'll have to wait until probably the start of free agency on March 9th to see the Seahawks.
To hear Ethan Stoll's perspective. Sorry.
You're so anti-Ethan Stoll.
I'm not anti-Ethan Stoll.
You are.
It seems strange that he's commenting on an arena proposal.
I'm sorry. Cleveland has more cap space, obviously.
It's like, why are you not on this panel? It's because you're not verified on Twitter.
I don't want...
You'd be like more Boulevard Park arenas. You're like... Where is the Boulevard Park talk? There was supposed to be an arena.
Kingdom was supposed to be right down the street from us. Yeah. Could have been. What a different life we would have led.
Wait, the Kingdom would have been in Boulevard Park, those talk?
Yeah, it was.
Like, you're going to bring back that proposal from 1975?
More South Park, but it was right by like the interchange between 509
you're
and there.
Like, tear down the bridge. Put an arena there.
Anyway, Cleveland technically with $109 million in cap space. The Niners second with $82 million in cap space. Well, let's wrap up here by talking about the long off season. The long wait is over. Seattle Sounders and MLS Soccer is back starting this Saturday when they take on the Houston Dynamo.
Finally back.
So they wrapped up preseason action.
The worst thing about having a short off season is that we have very little time to gloat as champions.
It's true. But we have the entire season to gloat as champions.
Okay.
They played their final two preseason games last week in Charleston, I should say, a 4-2 loss Wednesday versus expansion team Atlanta United, and a 1-0 loss on Saturday against the Columbus Crew, playing pretty much their regular starting lineup in that game on Saturday.
The Sounders were?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Stephen Fry, who had missed the entire preseason after spraining his ankle in the USMNT camp, returned and played the entire game. And Clint Dempsey went 82 minutes in this one. So very encouraging for the start of the
season. Clint's just Clint again.
So the other interesting bit of news here in advance of the start of the MLS season is a lot of smoke around the possibility of Japanese attacking midfielder, playmaker Keisuke Honda joining the Sounders from AC Milan.
Is there still smoke around that? Or
yeah, I mean, at one point, La Gazzetta dello Sport in Italy reported that it was, quote, a done deal awaiting a sign-off from ownership. Now, that's a trickier thing than it might sound, because currently, so AC Milan is owned by former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
Yes.
The communications magnet? Is that, let's say, controversial communications yeah. magnet. Is that a good way? He is selling it, apparently.
He might own La Gazzetta dello Sport.
I'm not sure, but he might. He is selling the team to a Chinese court consortium known as the Sino-Europe Group, but that deal has kept being delayed. It sounds like the newest deadline is the end of this week. So it's unclear which ownership group would have to sign off on this. Probably neither of them would really have an issue with it, although, you know, the fact that he is a Japanese, you know, an Asian player, and a Chinese group is buying the team might have some impact, but he's not playing right now.
He's an older striker.
Age 30.
For...
He's played 95 minutes this season.
A team that has no use for him.
So... It seems like a no-brainer, even though they're not getting a transfer fee, they'd just be getting rid of his wages. And for the Sounders, the salary would be reported by ESPN FC, which an MLS source told them, better than 50-50 chance this happens, that it would be a salary between $1 million and $1.5 million per year.
Okay, so not insane player.
No.
But Hunt is a perfect MLS player at this point.
Yes.
Right? He's somebody who's been a relative star. And is now,
especially for his national team.
Kind of toiling in obscurity. Where did he play? Did he play for Celtic?
No. He came to them from Cheska Moscow.
From Moscow?
Yeah.
I thought he had played for somebody bigger.
This was the only like really prominent European club he's played for.
He definitely had a period where he played for Milan, though.
And then has been, again, a huge fixture for the national team and has scored 8 goals so far in 2018 World Cup qualifying.
I mean, we talked about this before, but I'm very open. I think it's a great idea for the Sounders to bring in a Japanese star.
Yeah, from, you know, a marketing standpoint for both the player and the team. And so the interesting part about this, if they did get him, is how they would use him, because where he's generally been best is playing on the right wing and then cutting into his favored left foot, which is basically how the Sounders are using Lodero right now.
Okay.
Presumably, Lodero could switch back to the left side, play in the middle. You know, I'm sure they'd figure something out, but would be, some work there for Brian Schmetzer.
Or even just rotate the roster around. I mean, you know, Hanna's not a young player. He's not going to be starting every single match.
Do you want to talk about the Sounders season first or about Houston first?
I want to talk about the Sounders season because I want to get a sense of what the lineup is going to look like. Basically, the base Sounders lineup going into the 2017 season.
Yeah, so under Brian Schmetzer, this is his first training camp in charge of the team. First
kind of
season
insane.
Taking over midseason.
Kind of crazy.
And winning the MLS Cup. He has favored a 4-2-3-1 lineup. So at forward, most of the time, probably Jordan Morris in that spot, although now they have Will Bruin, who they acquired from Houston over the offseason, is kind of a different option in that position, more of like the pure classic target forward striker who the Sounders really haven't had, you know, probably since Nate Jaikwa. They've had, you know, a few guys like that. I guess Kenny Cooper was kind of towards that player, but, you know, not like really effective guys. Like Bruin is still relatively in his prime, so he'll play a lot.
When the Sounders brought Bruin in, there was some expectation that perhaps he would start.
And he still might, you know. There's some fluidity to how this lineup looks, but it seems like the best guess is Morris will be up top as the lone striker. So then as your three attacking midfielders, you'd have Alvaro Fernandez, Clint Dempsey, and Nicola Ladero. And then you've got Morris can play with that group if you bring in Bruin, or two of them can play up top. And then also Harry Shipp, who they also brought in as an MLS veteran this offseason.
Okay.
So as the defensive midfield, that's the one spot that completely unchanged from last season. Alonso and Christian Roldan solidified there. They played Shipp there in this last preseason match. So, you know, he could also be a factor there. And then Gustav Svensson, who they brought in from China, is also factors into the depth at defensive midfield.
Okay. Team sounding exactly the same to me.
It's very similar.
Seems like they determined they won the MLS Cup, and maybe let's just do that again and get Clint Dempsey back.
He still let several veterans go. You let Even Schitz go. You let Freeberg go. Nelson Valdez, who didn't do much during the regular season, but was key during the MLS Cup run. So the back line, three positions, you know, carrying over Jovan Jones, who was a nice injection of speed and youth to the roster last year, even though he's maybe not the most reliable defender. You finally get the Chad Marshall, Roman Torres back line, center back combination.
Love it.
That was really stout after they paired after Torres came back from his torn ACL. And then at right back with Tyrone Mears getting traded to Atlanta, in all likelihood, that'll probably be Brad Evans' spot.
I can see him playing that too.
Yeah, I mean, that's where he's played with for the national team, obviously. They also have brought in on trial former New England Revolution right back Darius Barnes, and it remains to be seen whether he'll make the final roster. He could start there if you're more interested in having Evans as sort of just kind of a wild card to provide depth in central midfield, at center back, you know, pretty much all over the park because he's played everywhere now.
Evans?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, and no change of goalie.
Yeah, Fry should be good to go.
So basically the team looks more or less exactly the same.
Again, I don't think it's exactly the same. It's similar, but it's not dramatic changes.
You know, and the thing about the MLS and soccer in particular versus a lot of the other sports is the changes that you make don't necessarily happen over the brief offseason. Right?
Yes, there's never been midseason trades, he said, after we talked about the Gary Payton Ray Allen trade.
But that's what I'm saying is most in the NFL and the NBA, most of the transactions happen over the offseason. In the MLS, this team could look very different by next August, next July, next September.
Well, I mean, obviously last season was one of the ultimate examples of that because Lodero came in midseason and completely transformed the team along with the coaching change.
So this isn't necessarily going to be the roster for the whole season.
And the indication, by the way, is Honda may not come in until after the end of the Milan season, which would be in June.
Okay.
If a deal does happen.
I would imagine that. I mean, it's still not a young roster.
No, there's a lot of 30 guys in their 30s. There's more younger talent interspersed in here. You now have Roldan established as a starter. Bruin, like I said, is a little bit younger. And you're younger. Well, I guess you're not younger. Right back of Tyrone.
You're not younger anyway. I mean,
if Brad Evans starts,
you've got Jordan Morris playing probably his last MLS season.
We'll see. I mean, the fact that you now have your three designated player spots filled makes it a little harder to keep him long term, but I'm sure they would find a way.
Ladero, who is 27,
he's right in his prime.
Dempsey's getting older.
Yes.
Alonso, who it's shocking that he's still playing.
Is it?
No, I mean, Alonso, who maintains at a high level, but yeah, probably
last year was as good a season he's ever. He's
probably
ever had
at
in Sounders
some
uniform.
Point is due for some severe regression.
I mean, he's an injury risk, but I don't agree with that.
And then Roldan, who's one of the other
age 21
up and coming young players on the team.
Yeah.
Beyond that, it's a pretty old team.
You know, I think they'll hope to work in some of the, you know, the players they signed as homegrown prospects this offseason and some of the draft picks, and we'll see, you know, what happens again over the course of the season. You know, Roldan this time a year ago, he was not looked at as a starter. He was just kind of someone who was in the mix for playing time. And then it was after Schmetzer took over that he became a full-time starter.
Okay.
I mean, on paper, this should be a stronger roster than last season's.
Yes.
That won the MLS Cup. I mean, I think, you know, you're looking at, again, contending for the Supporters' Shield for first place in the Western Conference is a realistic target.
Okay, it's a long season.
It's a long season. There's many teams.
It's February right now.
There's many teams that feel that same way, but it's realistic that this could be a better team than last year's team, despite the MLS Cup.
Okay.
Any other thoughts generally on the Sounders season? Any bold predictions? I think we already had made some at some point, but
it's such a long season. It's almost impossible to make bold predictions. It's like my bold prediction is that I think the team will look drastically different, despite the fact that we go into the season having the team look more or less the same as we saw, is that I think that the team in a lot of places will look very different come the summer.
I just don't think the team would agree with your assessment that they look more or less the same.
Who is different?
I mean, not of the starting lineup, but of the depth, it's substantially different.
Okay, and it's an important thing, changing over the depth.
And Evans wasn't starting last year in the playoffs.
Brad Evans is the player who's different?
Dempsey wasn't playing last year in the playoffs. Those are changes.
Okay, like, I sure, yes. The depth has changed, and there is some turnover, but the team still looks, you know, the core of the team is still exactly the same. And I'll be very curious to see how it goes. The other thing is, we have to see how much Jordan Morris, there's not a long offseason, how much Jordan Morris has progressed from last year to this
year. Well, I think, you know, had the taking the responsibility of being the primary goal scorer, obviously Lodero scored plenty of goals, but, you know, in terms of, you know, the traditional forwards, he was the guy after Dempsey went down.
Yes.
So that, I think, helped him in his development.
And so now this year he enters the season as the guy.
But the other thing is, you know, you're not able to mark him the same way if he's playing with Dempsey and with Lodero.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Let's talk about the Houston Dynamo.
So the Dynamo finished 10th in the West last season. Only the Chicago Fire had fewer points in the MLS in general. And changed coaches over the offseason after they had an interim coach at the end of last season. Brought in Wilmer Cabrera, who was coaching their USL affiliate in Rio Grande Valley. And previously coached Chivas USA during their... I don't know what the right word is for their final season in MLS. Chaotic, hectic.
Wait, what happened in their last season?
Oh, like the ownership was a disaster. Like the MLS was basically contracting the team. So it was bad. It got really bad at the end of that. There was like ongoing lawsuits about, you know, whether they had unfair labor practices by favoring Mexican players.
Like really?
Investigations into it. It was really ugly. That's why they got rid of them entirely.
You're just like, we're over this. It's kind of amazing that in a league that's so desperate to expand that they contracted a team.
Yeah. Well, they're going back to LA with a different ownership group next year. Or 2 years from now at some point.
I think that's next year, 2018.
So Cabrera will play a 4-3-3, and they've overhauled the roster and particularly focused on adding South American players. Kind of the logic being that it's easier for them to go to Houston because of the extreme heat during the summer than it is for players from, say, Northern Europe, is kind of their thinking here. So they've got now, they brought in two Hondurans to play on top, Elberth Ellis, who's on loan from Monterrey, and Romel Kyoto from Olimpia Honduras, the kind of the dominant team down there. And an interesting quote here from one of their other new players, AJ De La Garza, who is an MLS veteran and came from the LA Galaxy. It kind of feels like an expansion team. They have a lot of turnover from last year, a lot of new guys brought in, and obviously hired a new coaching staff, brought in some players who are not familiar with MLS and a couple who are. We have to be on the same page quickly. We have 7 of our first 10 games at home. We have to take advantage of that, and to do that, we have to be on the same page. It's a good opportunity for us to get off on the right foot, so we have to make sure we take it. So that's what he told Goal.com. So sounds like the Sounders may benefit here from continuity as they go up against this Houston team.
Yeah. And so this is on Saturday. The season's kicking off.
Saturday night, 5:30 p.m.
And they're two weeks on the road before the Sounders will unveil the banner here at home.
Yes, because of the fact that they're doing some renovations to Key Arena. To Key Arena. This is essentially
Key Arena. Wow! Spoiler alert! You heard it here first!
They're doing some renovations to Century League Field, and those will not be complete in time for the start of the season.
Okay, so that's why it seemed kind of crazy that they were not after winning.
Yeah, wasn't like the MLS like hating on the Sounders?
They were like, it's have fun in Houston.
There's championship, guys. No, it's because of that that they
okay. Start that makes a lot more sense now.
And they couldn't start doing any of that until after the end of the Seahawks home season, so that was kind of tricky.
Oh, well, good thing that they only hosted. That's why they lost the 49ers. Not to the 49ers, to the Cardinals, to make sure that they had only one home playoff game.
Yes, that's great strategy there.
if they would have clinched a bye, that would have been rough for the Sounders.
I'm excited. I mean, after the grit you've shown getting that hat, I think you're ready for the nine-month MLS season.
Oh, I am so ready. I mean, at this point last year, I was not ready. Right,
I can't even remember the start of the MLS season at this point.
Oh, you don't remember? We went to it. It was terrible.
Oh, yeah. No, I can't. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think in the first week of the MLS season was like...
O'Neill Fisher got red carded?
Fisher got red carded. Somebody was injured severely. I think it was O'Neill who got injured.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Anyway, it was a very rough game. And we were there for those first 4 months of the MLS season. And they were horrible.
I mean, horrible is a bit strong, but yeah.
It was a rough 4 months.
Nothing about them indicated that the Sounders were about to win the MLS Cup, let's put it that way.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
That's why entering the MLS season is a very strange experience.
Yeah.
So anyway, no matter what happens, none of this matters, because nothing in the MLS matters until about July.
Well, making the playoffs matters, but yes. And we'll see what mid-season additions the LA Galaxy inevitably bring in to try to beef up and compete with the Sounders.
I hope that they have some grit and pick up a burger hat.
All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.